Hey, what's going on? It's At the Letters for Thursday, March 18th. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith. Our producers are Christian Ryan and Mike Tassoni. Ben, we are 2 weeks away from the opening of the 2021 regular season for the Toronto Blue Jays, and that cannot come 2 weeks soon enough for a lot of reasons. Primary among them, pitchers starting to get hurt. Guys are starting to get injured here at spring training, which is something that happens every spring. But for the Blue Jays, whose pitching staff will say was not the strength of this club, they've been dealt a couple of blows here recently, with Nate Pearson re-aggravating a groin injury that he picked up earlier in camp, and Thomas Hatch coming out of his start with elbow discomfort the other day on Wednesday here. Ben, let's start with Pearson. We were speculating that he was not going to be ready for opening day when he originally hurt his groin. Club still not saying that's a sure thing. I feel pretty confident in suggesting that Nate Pearson is not going to be ready for opening day of the 2021 season, likely, depending on how he recovers, not towards late April, perhaps even early May.
Yeah, I mean, the timelines are always a moving target, but very safe to say opening day just doesn't look realistic. And that's tough for Pearson. It's tough for this Blue Jays team. He was, you know, as you start to map out what the rotation could look like, ideally, I think for a lot of people, he would have been that number two, the guy behind Ryu with the most upside. And it's been 2 weeks now that he's been battling this groin issue. 2 weeks to go before opening day. That's not enough time, especially because, you know, we have no indication that he's actually back at full strength. So even once he gets to full strength, whenever that is, it will take time again to ramp up. So as you said, far from ideal. I think there's also the developmental cost, right? We think about guys like Alek Manoah, Simeon Woods Richardson, these prospects. We're getting the chance to pitch in spring training and learn from these opportunities. And that's so great for them. But, you know, Pearson's not that much older. He's got a year on Manoah. Doesn't have a ton of pro experience. This should be a chance for Nate Pearson to be testing himself. Doesn't get to do it right now.
Yeah, more than anything, you just want him pitching right now, and he's not able to do it. You know, it's interesting with the groin injury reoccurring. Like, I would assume that, you know, he was working really hard to get back as early in the season as possible, and so I wonder if they'll be more cautious this time around and make sure that, like, you really get that injury out of there and you really get him over it. You don't want this to be something that he's battling throughout the season and that he's carrying throughout the year, because look, the most important thing is not that Nate Pearson is available to pitch in the first series of the season or the third or the fourth series. It's that he is available to pitch in September and October, and is that he is peaking then, and he is, like, feeling his best and effective and giving you good innings at that point in the year. So you want to take this point in the season to really smooth that out and really get him over that injury. Go ahead, Ben.
No, I agree with you. You know, and it reminds me a little of George Springer in that discussion we had a couple weeks ago, where it's kind of like, you know what, this is the time to rest. And no doubt the same logic applies here. Got to rest it. I mean, at the same time, And I agree with you too, that September, October, those are the most important months, but you also have to be in a position where you're contending in those months, right? Like, if they're 500 on September 1st and Nate Pearson is ready to go and he's feeling amazing, you're kind of, you know, you have half of a solution there. Like, so they've got to probably use Nate Pearson's ability to get them through those first 130 games of the season. And to be fair, we still expect that to happen, but not to start the year.
Yeah, and this means that Ross Stripling is likely to make a start there in the first week for the Blue Jays, whereas he might not have made a start if Nate Pearson was healthy, although he also might have if the Blue Jays had decided to roll six starters, or if they had done some interesting things with their rotation, as much as their rotation will resemble a rotation this season. I think the big sort of downstream effect is that it opens a spot in the bullpen for a long guy and for somebody who can give you some length. And whether that's going to be like an Anthony Kay, a Trent Thornton, or a TJ Zoik even, I think that is, like, really the sort of impact of Nate Pearson not being ready for the start of the season. It's interesting. You would think it would be more of an impact on the rotation, but I think it's actually more of an impact on the bullpen.
Yeah, maybe in a kind of practical game-to-game sense, right? You're looking at that roster, you're looking at that pitching staff. That might be where you feel the absence of Pearson the most, for sure. So that's one variable there. And like I said, I mean, it's just, it's not that you necessarily connect dots between these injuries that Pearson's had over the years, because he got hit by a line drive in the elbow. You know, like that's totally unpredictable. That's like the definition of a fluke injury. Last year, all right, that was a flexor strain. That's not a fluke injury. That's a usage, just the pitchers get hurt injury. And then the groin, you know, who knows? So I'm not trying to connect dots here, but every time a pitcher, a developing pitcher misses time, it's time that he's missing to improve, you know, to get those reps in, to build his confidence, to work on his off speed, whatever advantage pitchers get out of facing the top competition and testing themselves, Pearson's not getting that right now.
And it's something that could have created an opportunity for Thomas Hatch to sneak onto this roster. But that as well seems extremely unlikely now after he comes out of Wednesday's outing with the elbow discomfort. And Ben, like you mentioned, the pitchers getting hurt thing. I mean, pitchers get hurt. And that one was difficult to watch. And as we sit here now on Thursday, March 18th, we don't know the results of his MRI. Like, we don't know what the official injury is. We're not going to speculate on it. But I mean, just watching him have to call out for the trainer, watch him come off the mound, you know, after throwing that pitch and like clearly not feeling right and clearly processing a lot of emotion and dealing with a lot of things. I mean, that's one of those ones that just like covering this game and getting to know pitchers and athletes and how hard they work and just how much goes into being at that level. Like that is one of the toughest ones to watch. It's like you were saying with like something acute, like a comeback or like Nate Pearson caught. It's like, okay, yeah, you broke a bone on a comebacker, but like, you know, that's a freak injury and we kind of know the timeline for that. And you can feel pretty confident that a guy will be able to get over that. But like when it's something like this, like an elbow issue, and it's something that clearly for a number of pitches before the one where he really was feeling it, it's clearly something he was working through, something he was carrying on the mound. Those are the ones that I find just really hard to watch.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you watch enough baseball and you see them. You know, I think back to Tim Mesa, end of 2019.
Yeah.
That's another one. You see them usually every year or so, whether it's a visiting pitcher or Blue Jays pitcher, they definitely happen. It's always tough to watch. And like you said, if you go back through it, and Shai in his piece on the injury kind of goes through and shows some of those actions that you're talking about there, Arden, where it's like, you know, he's obviously in some sort of discomfort and yet he keeps trying to pitch. And I mean, hindsight is 20/20. Obviously, knowing what we know now, of course, he shouldn't have even been pitching beyond that initial bit of soreness. But in the moment, pitchers work through things. Is it a cramp? Is it not? Like, it's hard to know. And of course, he's the guy who knows his body the best. So you trust him and it just didn't work out this time.
Well, and that's always the push-pull for pitchers, right? Because I think that generally speaking, every MLB pitcher is injured to some degree at all times, you know? Like not like famously, you know, like surgeons, doctors will tell you, like you take an MRI on any MLB pitcher's arm and or elbow and shoulder, you know, if you go in there arthroscopically, like they'll find something to do. They'll find some fraying, they'll find some tearing, they'll find a procedure they can complete. Trent Thornton, man, like we were just talking about him last year or 2 years ago, and then at the beginning of last season, had four bone chips floating around in his elbow, two the size of molars. And he was pitching through that. Like, and he was showing me on Zoom, like how he could move them around in his elbow. And he got to a point during an outing last year where one of them got lodged and like locked up his arm. And so he couldn't extend his arm. He already could not extend his arm fully or flex his arm fully, but then it locked it at like a 65 degree angle type of deal. And he had to like wedge out this bone chip from his elbow. Like, imagine that. Oh, this guy's competing in the major leagues, going through this, like moving around bone chips in his elbow. Like every pitcher is going through something like that. And that you're referring to, it is kind of the push-pull of like, what is the discomfort and the pain that pitchers pitch through all the time and are actually kind of like expected to pitch through and feel like they have to pitch through because they have to be on the mound in order to make money and in order to like continue their big league career and in order to keep getting innings and starts and to get through their 0-3 years, get to ARB, have counting stats where they can get rewarded there and then hopefully be healthy enough to get a free agent deal and finally get paid on the back end of their careers. Like, where is the threshold between that discomfort and that pain that you are always dealing with on the mound and then something that is a more drastic injury? And I think it can turn pretty quickly.
Think about Masahiro Tanaka, who, you know, for years and years in the major leagues when he was with the Yankees, you know, there was always this expectation that he's one pitch away. And he had, I'm not sure if it was a partial tear or what the exact, you know, injury description was, but he wasn't totally right. And yet he was able to pitch through it and get great results. I mean, right now, the Padres with Denelson Lamet, same thing. Like, there's something going on there. No one knows the exact severity. I mean, maybe Lamet does, maybe AJ Preller, but pretty much it's an open secret, though, across the game that he's pitching through some stuff. And with some guys, it works. And you can be Masahiro Tanaka and deliver full value on a seven-year, I think it was $155 million deal. And then in some cases, it doesn't work. And we don't know where Thomas Hatch is going to end up on that. I mean, as we record this, we haven't heard from the Blue Jays what the results of that MRI will be.
Yeah, no, there's a possibility it's just a nerve thing. There's a possibility it's not as bad as it looked. But like you mentioned with Tanaka and with, you know, UCL tears, like that's not like an acute trauma thing, UCL tear. It's not like you just like throw one pitch and they're like, you just tore your whole UCL. Like that is something that develops over time. And that is like wear and tear. Like the ligament kind of degrades with like every time you throw this little rock at 95 miles per hour, like you just degrade it a little bit more. Like a lot of times you will see players opt for conservative treatment on UCL tears, just partial tears, right? That you can get a PRP injection, you know, you can just like rest and just try to like basically slow things down and buy yourself some time so that you can keep pitching with a partially torn ligament like Tanaka was. But that gets back to what I was saying before. You're still going to feel that every time you take the mound. And that's still going to take a ton of work before games, between starts, just to get your arm to a place where you're able to go out there and compete and execute. It's kind of like that. It's like such a classic misconception that Tommy John surgery somehow like makes pitchers better. You know what I mean? Because they often like come back throwing better than they were prior to it. Like you see now, like Tim Mayza is out here, like, you know, mid 90s and his stuff looks electric. It's like, well, yeah, because he was pitching injured prior to that, because he was pitching through pain before, you know, he was compensating for this. Pitchers who right up until, look at Ken Giles, right? Like right up until the point that you get Tommy John surgery, like you were clearly pitching through a very serious injury. That's going to impact your stuff, you know? And so you get Tommy John and you take 12 to 18 months to not throw and to actually repair your injury and to actually heal. Yeah, no kidding, you're going to come back and look pretty good. You took 12 to 18 months off of doing this incredibly unnatural thing that all pitchers do. The other side of that is there is like tremendous pressure on pitchers to continue to compete and to perform, because there's always this wave of other dudes coming from beneath you in the system and being drafted every year, you know, trying to take your job, right? Like Tim Mayza, off the 40-man roster, right? After getting his Tommy John surgery. Now he's back in camp as a non-roster invitee, like trying to fight his way back on so that he can make the big league minimum. Like you take 12 to 18 months off at a certain point in your career. Look at Ken Giles, right? And what it looked like he might be able to get in free agency and, you know, goes off for Tommy John surgery and doesn't get anywhere close to that. This is why pitchers pitch through these things, but it is such a balancing act for guys when they're on the mound pitching with discomfort.
Yeah, no, it definitely is that balancing act. And I guess every pitcher has to navigate that himself and figure out what that threshold of pain looks like, what's going too far. That's a really difficult thing, I'm sure. And, you know, again, we don't know exactly where it's going to lead for Thomas Hatch. You think lots of guys, you know, sometimes it's a little rest and rehab and they're back. Lots of guys, it's under the knife and you're out for 12 to 18 months. So in the meantime, the Jays pitching depth is clearly compromised with no Pearson, no Thomas Hatch. I mean, those are two guys that in this rotation should have been contributors and may still be. Of course, in Pearson's case, he will still be a contributor to this staff. But you think about the Jays went into this season trying to do a volume game, trying to say we have a lot of guys that we're comfortable with, and we believe the volume will maybe make up for the fact that there's not as much impact. And now that volume is starting to decrease.
Well, and you mentioned Pearson. Like, that's a good point, right? Like, that's why the Blue Jays built as much depth as they did. And we've got an entire season to talk about, you know, Blue Jays pitching depth and who's going to fill in the rotation. And we're going to be having plenty of these conversations about pitchers
getting hurt this year, man. Like, I really think coming off of the disruption to everybody's rhythm and routine last season, it is like truly unprecedented times in MLB. I know that word gets thrown around a lot right here in 2020, 2021, but really, like, even, you know, in wartime situations, like, MLB hasn't been through something like this. And I don't think any organization actually knows how arms are going to respond and how many pitchers are, you know, going to be injured this year, aren't going to be able to answer the bell. But I mean, you mentioned Pearson, and you're right, we can't connect the dots between the injuries he has suffered throughout his career. What we do know is he throws awfully hard, and there, you know, there does seem to be somewhat of a correlation between like throwing really, really hard and suffering injuries. Like, you think about like what pitching actually is. You are essentially just transferring force or energy from the ground through you into a baseball to propel it forward. Like I understand that's like the psilocybin way of looking at it, but like that is what it is, right? You are just the conduit. Like, you're just kind of in the middle, and the more velocity you are putting into that baseball that you were hurling towards the plate, I mean, that means more energy transferring through you, right? And that means there are more ways that things can go wrong, you know, especially if you're like 6'6", 260. There's a lot of like joints and tissue and muscle and ligaments in there where stuff can go awry if your movement patterns aren't efficient, you know, if you aren't, you know, pitching in a way that you ever look at those freeze frames of pitchers like at the height of their delivery right before they're about to deliver the ball, and like you look at the positions that their arms are in.
You look at like the close-up of their elbow, and you look at like the way the veins pop, and it's like, man, that's pretty intense.
This is not natural, and this is why, you know, clubs are investing as much as they are in biomechanics, right, and in motion capture, and in trying to iron out some of these movement inefficiencies so that players can better transfer that energy into the ball so that you aren't at risk of injury. But it is also kind of like the double-edged sword of like high velocity, right? You look at a guy like Nate Pearson. This is a guy who does everything right. Like, this is a guy who has a personalized arm care routine. This is a guy who's working a drive line to find those movement pattern inefficiencies. Like, this is a guy who eats right. Remember, he was on the podcast last year and he was telling us all about his routine. He pitches with like a device on his wrist that tracks his like heart rate variability, tracks his workload in between outings. He does everything.
But you can't.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like, he does everything you're supposed to do and still obviously had the flexor situation last year. So like, even a guy who is like nailing everything and covering all of his bases can still bump up against something like this. It's just a situation where every pitcher is going to be injured. Like, every pitcher gets hurt. It's unbelievable. You know, like, do you watch what Jacob deGrom does for the Mets? It's amazing. It's incredible watching him throw like 100 in spring games. It's nuts. But there's always got to be that little bit of your mind that's watching that and being like, man, I hope this lasts. Man, I hope he can do this for a while.
Totally. And I, you know, DeGrom's an interesting example because I have that same thought sometimes when you see the 100 or the 99 or, you know, he's basically sitting in that range in a spring game. It's just incredible. But at the same time, you know, DeGrom, who I want to say, I should have this in front of me, I want to say he's 33 years old. You know, he's not the youngest player out there. And this is when he's peaking. And I think that he's a reminder that pitching a lot of the time just takes a while to fully develop. And it's in contrast to the young position players that we're seeing, where you have Juan Soto, Ronald Acuna Jr., Fernando Tatis. I mean, these guys are historically just like unbelievable players. They are 21, 22 years old. They're in their prime right away. Best players in baseball right away. But for pitching, it just doesn't seem to work that way these days. And, you know, whether it's Verlander and Scherzer maintaining their success deep, deep into their 30s, you know, obviously DeGrom, Cole, Bieber, you know, Bieber's relatively young compared to those guys, but he's still a college pitcher. He's still not 22 years old, you know? So I think that the best pitchers in baseball tend to need some time. And so I would use that as a bit of a optimistic counterpoint to the Pearson throws hard stuff, because, you know, I see some of this, I'm sure you see it too, Arden, where it's like, you know, Pearson is he's just another Aaron Sanchez, which, by the way, wouldn't be the worst thing in the world, because Sanchez, you know, led the league in ERA 5 years ago. And so there are worse outcomes in this world than being Aaron Sanchez. But, you know, even if Pearson were to reach those heights and plateau there, that probably would be disappointing given the amount of expectations surrounding him. But I think we just got to be patient when it comes to the pitchers that we watch, the young pitchers that we watch coming up in Major League Baseball. And so for the Tigers, maybe that's Casey Mize. For the Blue Jays, it's Nate Pearson. Every organization has these guys coming up, and they're just not all going to be at the height of their potential right away. It's going to take some time.
Yeah, miss me with the Aaron Sanchez comparisons, you know, people on Twitter and the replies, right? Like, you know, and I'm sure you see this when you update Nate Pearson's status and you get like gifts of Band-Aids and things like, just, you have no idea, you cowards. Like, you have no idea what these guys are going through. Like, you have no idea how much stuff Aaron Sanchez pitched through until literally, like, he could no longer grip the ball. This is what we've been saying for throughout this segment, is that like pitchers are going through, like pitching through a lot of discomfort and a lot of pain when they're out there, you know, like, and you hear the, like, people will say, well, you know, Randy Johnson never got hurt. And like, you know, Nolan Ryan threw 9,000 innings a season. And like, why can't today's pitchers do that? They're soft. And like, no, like those guys were outliers, extreme outliers. You know how many thousands of pitchers in that era like never made it to the big leagues because they just shredded their arms and they had plenty of velo and plenty of ability and just never got there? Or even guys who did get to the big leagues, but because of the toll, the tax that was paid to get there, washed away, because once they were there, their labrum was friggin' spaghetti squash.
And those guys ended up, you know, managing a hotel chain, or they went back to school and became a professor, teacher or something. Like, we don't even know their names.
No, yeah, that's like, the only thing you can learn from like pointing at, you know, Randy Johnson and Nolan Ryan and guys like that is that like you have fallen victim to survivorship bias, really, right? Yeah. Like, it's just, that's the thing with today's era is also that like the velocity, like toothpaste it out of the tube. Like, it's not going, we're not reverting to soft tossers. Like, I don't think that all of a sudden you're going to see like Marco Estrada's and Joey Murray's like coming out of, you know, like populating entire AAA staffs. Like, it's, guys are throwing harder and harder, and every bullpen is full of like these hulking dudes with slicked back hair who throw these like upper 90s fastballs with some sort of crazy spinning breaking weapon.
The hair is always slicked back, always.
It is always. And because that has been like institutionalized to the grassroots level, right? Where like now, like amateurs, like teenagers understand, okay, if I want to get noticed by all these scouts who show up to our games with radar guns, I gotta put a big number on that guy's radar gun. And when I go and throw on, you know, at the on a Rapsodo, or I go and pitch somewhere where there's track, man, like, I gotta spin my stuff like crazy. So I'm gonna throw really hard with a ton of spin, and that's how I'm gonna get drafted, or that's how I'm gonna get signed out of the Caribbean, and that's like how I'm gonna try to live my dream. So like, that's why you're getting all these, you know, and people at the grassroots level have been like complaining about this for years, about how like kids are getting hurt earlier than ever. Kids are getting Tommy John in high school, and because everybody's trying to throw super hard. But I'd like, that toothpaste is not going back into the tube. Like, this is where it is. So this is all to say, like, I just really think that, you know, like the next frontier of baseball innovation is going to be like keeping players on the field, is going to be health and like injury prevention. Because right now, like, there isn't even really a reliable way to predict injury other than like past injury. Like, that's the one sort of reliable predictor of future injury, is past injury. Otherwise, like, it's so hard to tell. Like, Thomas Hatch might be able to get through that outing on Wednesday like 99 times out of 100, and then he hits that 100th time and he has to come out of the game, and who knows where he's going, right? But like, most, that guy was clearly pitching through something for a while. Thomas Hatch had to sit out all of the 2015 college season with the UCL sprain. And then 2016, when he was drafted by the Cubs, after pitching a year at college, they didn't send him out to the minors. They shut him down for the rest of the year and didn't send him out because they said, hey, you need to rest and you need to like get over what you are dealing with. So like, clearly he was pitching through something for a while, but you just don't have a way of predicting that as a club. So I think that whichever team can like biomechanically like figure this out, which is like so hard to do, but what are you gonna do? You're gonna try to catch up in the like analytics arms race, which was run friggin' 15 years ago, or the player development arms race, which has already been running for a while. Like, that's the next one, is like keeping guys on the field and figuring out a way to just, because that's a massive advantage, is if you can actually keep your players healthy and competing more often than your competitors.
For sure. And I mean, even if you nudge it forward a couple percentage points, that's probably a success. I mean, I don't think anyone's stopping arm injuries. I just don't. No. I think as long as guys are throwing max effort, which, as you say, that is the way things go. I mean, that's the game. You know, if that's the case, then guys are going to get hurt. And as you say, you're not going back, because realistically, some of these pitchers who are on the injured list, and we're going to continually see guys placed on the injured list this year, both because teams want to be cautious and because guys will get hurt. But some of those guys could probably pitch at 80% effort and be 80% effective. That's just not the expectation. That's not what teams ask of guys. They want 100% effort. They want 100% effectiveness. And so, you know, maybe in the 70s, it was different. Or maybe the drop-off in the 70s was so big that, you know, or the 60s, pick your decade, that it was so big that to go from Don Drysdale to the seventh guy in the Dodgers bullpen was like actually just a cliff you did not want to fall off of. Whereas now the Dodgers bullpen is just loaded with these other guys who can step up. So there's a huge difference. I do want to go back just to the age point here to throw a few ages at you. And this is totally anecdotal, totally unscientific. Just did this while you were chatting there, Arden. So a few ages for you. Jacob DeGrom, 32. Shane Bieber, okay, he's young, but he's 25. He's not 21. Kenta Maeda. These, by the way, this is from the Cy Young voting in 2020. So these are the best pitchers last year.
Great.
Kenta Maeda, 32. Hyunjin Ryu, 33. Gerrit Cole, 30. Lucas Giolito, he's 26. But by the way, a couple years ago in 2018, he literally led the league in walks and earned runs. So all of this to say that it takes time for these guys to be really good. And sometimes it takes injuries, sometimes it takes experience, and sometimes it takes working through some ugly results at the major league level. And doesn't mean Nate Pearson's going to be good, because a lot of hype prospects still suck and they still don't deliver on their promise. But we can't say that Nate Pearson won't be good. That's where I like, don't say that he won't be good. That's the one thing that I would hope people can agree on.
No, it's an absurd thing to say. And like, what a reversal in 12 months. Remember what we were saying about Nate Pearson, what everybody was saying about Nate Pearson 12 months ago? Like, I'll never forget being at that game in Bradenton against the Pirates when he made like some really good Pirates hitters look like amateurs, like, and look foolish. And Nate Pearson had like the kind of the arc that Alek Manoah is on right now at Blue Jays camp. It's what Nate Pearson was on this time last year. I feel like, wasn't Dallas Keuchel up there in the Cy Young?
He was. I didn't get to all last year's, but yes.
But that's another like veteran guy. Lance Lynn has been like one of the most underrated dudes of the last, you know, 2 to 3 seasons.
Yeah. Charlie Morton. There are a lot of old good pitchers.
Jay Happ pitched really effectively into his mid-30s.
His 30s were way better than his 20s. And this is anecdotal. Like, you know, you could do a whole study on it, but you just don't see guys, and maybe Kamar Rocker and Jack Leiter will be the counterpoint to this, and I hope it happens, but you rarely see guys go straight out of the draft to just being these, or out of high school. I mean, that never happens, to just being these dominant players the way that we've seen with on the position player side.
No, that might be a little bit of the survivorship bias too, though, if we're just pointing to the like 10 effective mid-30s guys still throwing in MLB, right? Like, how many guys have, you know, bled away? And those are just the ones that are left.
Yeah, but okay, here's how many elite 21 to 23 year old major league pitchers are?
Yeah, I know. It's small.
Honestly, there's not that many of them.
No, it's like pitching these days in the majors organizationally, it's just like, it's like a war of attrition. Like, you just get as much of it as possible and you see what works out, and like, you see who doesn't get hurt, and you know see who's still effective, and you see who's able to get outs, and like, and you just kind of at the end you see what you're left with, right? It's like you go on like these bombing runs in like World War II or something. It's like you see which planes come back, right? Like, that's kind of what it becomes, is this war of attrition. You mentioned the bullpens, right, with the Dodgers, where it's like, oh, like this guy is underperforming right now and that guy's hurt and we've overused this guy. Okay, just pull the friggin' paper towel dispenser down and here's another due to slick back hair, throw a 98 with this ridiculous slider. And like the Rays bullpen has been similar recently. Like that's something that we see a lot of, obviously covering the Blue Jays. And hey, Toronto's bullpen is starting to look a little bit like that. If you're like, if you get like, you know, prime Kirby Yates, then you've got like Jordan Amano and like Ryan Barucki and Rafael Dolis, like all throwing, Julian Merriweather, like all throwing hard as hell coming out of that bullpen. You know, that's just kind of what MLB pitching is right now, is this war of velocity attrition.
That's right. You can never have enough of it. And the Jays are going to have to make do. We'll really find out some stuff about Steven Matz and Ross Stripling and Tanner Roark and Robbie Ray, right? This is, we're gonna find out whether the Blue Jays were right to bank on this group.
No doubt. Let's step away, but when we come back, we'll wrap up everything else going on at Blue Jays camp when we continue on At the Letters. It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson Smith, our producers, Christian Ryan, Mike Tassoni. We thank them as always, and we thank you for listening. Please subscribe, like, share, tell your friends. We'll be here all season. All right, Ben, we got the bad news out of the way in the first half, got the injury stuff out of the way. Let's look at some good pitching news. We kind of hinted at it a little bit that like Alek Manoah has arrived and Blue Jays fans are getting to see, you know, why the organization is so high on him, you know, why people across the game are very excited about him. And they're getting to see like a lot of the development that has occurred with Alek Manoah since he was drafted a couple of years ago in the first round. And it's like, it's not just the stuff. The stuff obviously is phenomenal. Like it's, you know, he has two big league ready weapons in his fastball and his slider. I've said on the podcast before, I've written it a million times, like I think this guy could get high leverage outs in the major leagues today as a reliever out of the bullpen. But that is not the optimal outcome for Alek Manoah. That's not what the Blue Jays want. That's not what Alek wants. They want him to be a starter. They don't want him coming in to face like two to three batters. They want him taking two to three trips through the order. And in order to do that, you have to have different ways to get hitters out. If you're just fastball slider as a starter, you know, hitters just gonna sit on your fastball. And especially on days where you can't locate your slider for strikes, like you, I don't care how hard you throw, man, you're screwed. These hitters are really good. They'll hunt your fastball and they will damage it. What Alek Manoah showed against the Yankees to me was that he has different avenues to get hitters out and he has different ways to use his stuff. It was the sequencing that impressed me so much about that outing. It wasn't just that he struck out seven Yankees hitters in a row. It's that he struck them out seven different ways. You know, like he started guys with fastballs and then went to a slider. He dropped first pitch sliders for strikes and then came back with the fastball. He was locating changeups for strikes, again, swing and miss with the third pitch. To me, that's the big thing that I've seen from Alek Manoah this spring, is that development and that ability to attack hitters in different ways, because that's what's going to allow him to be effective as a big league starter.
For sure. For sure. I mean, I don't think there's a wrong way to strike out seven Yankees in a row. he did it, you know, the right way with, as you're saying, there's some sequencing and some different pitches, you know, some creativity to the approach. But yeah, seven Yankees in a row, struck out, retired all nine he faced. That's best case scenario. And it doesn't mean that he's major league ready. It doesn't mean that the time is now to start him in the major leagues. Like, honestly, I don't know. Like, I wouldn't even entertain the idea of starting him in the majors. And yet, truly impressive. But to me, like, Arden, would you, like, does it even cross your mind that he might?
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Because, and I don't think the Blue Jays are seriously contemplating starting him in the major leagues. Obviously, they they reassigned him to the minor league, so he will not be starting with the major league team. But to me, it's not even a question. He needs to go to the minor leagues and he needs to work on some of those things that you can only do as a starting pitcher, which is to say, working through that lineup many times, working through his pitches and using the changeup more and using all of his pitches to make sure that he's testing hitters and testing himself in as many ways as possible.
Yeah, he has six appearances as a professional in games that matter. He has a few more in spring training this year, but he's been in six games. He has 17 professional innings. Yeah, he's not going to break camp with the team. There's like a whole crew of prospects ahead of him who, like, sure, like stuff-wise, I'm not here to suggest that like TJ Zoic has better stuff than Alek Manoah or like Trent Thornton does or Joey Murray does, but those guys are going to get opportunities first because they are just more polished and refined as starters. And like they have just put in more kind of developmental sweat equity, as it were. Could Alek Manoah be an option for this club later on in the season, particularly out of the bullpen? Absolutely. For sure he could. He goes off to the alt site and has a, you know, another a strong sort of April development, starts the minor league season at like double A and, you know, is puts like some hay in the barn developmentally with being a starter, you know, and really makes some strides, continues to refine his approach, innings getting up there. And then you get to like, you know, August, September and you're the Blue Jays and like maybe you got a Jordan Romano injury or whatever. And, you know, Kirby Yates gets hurt. You need a big arm out of the bullpen. You're in a playoff race. You're looking ahead to the playoffs. For sure, you can bring in an Alek Manoah to like just blow gas out of the bullpen and come in and attack the New York Yankees. He's shown you can do it. Great. But you're absolutely not breaking camp with him as a starter. That's crazy.
Yeah, no chance of that happening. And, you know, I think even later in the season, there doesn't have to be an injury for him to be someone sure. that, you know, could be on the radar. And we're skipping a few steps here. Like, he would still have to, A, be healthy, which, as we talked about in the first segment, not a guarantee exactly for anyone.
Hey, this is the conversation we were having about Nate Pearson last year, right?
Yeah, exactly. So he's got to stay healthy. That's not a given. And then beyond that, he's got to perform. And, you know, doing something really impressive in spring training, it's amazing. It's great. Like, that would be, it's probably, you know, one of the more exciting moments, I would imagine, for a young pitcher to do that. It certainly is only pitched in 7 games, so it's definitely in his top 7. But it's, yeah, it's a good sign, but he's still got to improve. He's still got to develop and show that he can locate in the zone, that his velocity is holding up, that he is not showing those signs of fatigue that we talk about. And if he checks those two boxes of being healthy and producing, then I really do see a path to him pitching for this team in the play, or not in the playoffs necessarily, but first things first, late in the season, down the stretch, maybe helping them get there.
Let me pose a weird question to you, as long as we're talking about first round picks and pitchers. Alek Manoah, as you mentioned, pretty exciting spring. I'm sure in the Blue Jays front office, they're very excited by what they've seen from Alek Manoah. Do you think that, like, the developmental nerds that these guys are, they're actually more excited about what TJ Zoic has shown this spring?
Oh, man.
You know what I mean?
Good question. Yeah, I know what you mean. No, I don't think so.
No?
No. No.
No.
No.
A little bit.
Do you think so?
No. Maybe a little bit, man. Maybe a little bit. So I remember this time last spring, TJ Zoic was throwing like 87, 88, dude.
Not good. Right?
Like, and super no bueno. He was getting shelled by minor leaguers. I remember having a conversation with somebody in Dunedin when that was happening, and it was just kind of like, we got to figure this out. Like, what is going on here? And then he went off to the alt site. It's actually kind of gets back to a lot of what we were talking about in the first half about like movement inefficiencies. Like his mechanics were just all out of whack. Like, he just was not powering through the baseball very well, and he was losing a lot of velocity. Like, he was not staying back over his legs. Like, he was relying too much on his shoulder to generate velocity. Like, you think about it as a pitcher, like, in transferring that sort of energy and that force from the ground through the ball, like, you want it to go to start legs and then hips and then torso and then shoulder and elbow and hand. But his shoulder was ahead of everything, so he had to, you know, get in front of the high-speed cameras and the motion capture and work with the Rapsodo and all that stuff just to, like, you know, correct those movement inefficiencies and get to a place where he could tap back into the velocity that made him a first-round pick. And he also, you know, made some adjustments with his pitch mix and his usage. I think he got on a really good strength and conditioning program that helped him regain some of that velo. The moral of the story is, like, by the end of last season, he was throwing like 93, 94 out of the Jays bullpen. The other day at camp, he's like 95, 96.
Which is great. Which is
great. Which is, people are raving about him. So I do kind of think within the front office, they're kind of like, like a little bit more excited, because, like, I think the Blue Jays front office knew Alek Manoah was good, and they knew his fastball was sick and his slider is legit. He's got that, like, cutter slider that he can tighten up for strikes or make sweepier to get swing and miss. Like, I think the front office, like, they knew that Alek Manoah had that. But with TJ Zoic, they were like, you know, to them, I think that's a really big organizational success story in terms of all the people who were pulled in to sort of help that process.
No doubt. It looks good. Now, you know, for it to be a success story, he's got to do it in the majors. You know, it's got to make a difference. Like, spring training, Manoah, Zoic, like, none of this counts. They have to do it in the majors. So now it's promising. But, and I can see what you're saying. Like, I could see how right. the Jays might, in a way, you know, it's kind of like found money. It's a first round pick, so it's not yeah. truly found money.
No, they spent some money.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. It was a bonus.
Because of where he you know, was at, you know, let's say a year ago, to recover from that, to progress from that is significant. I still think, though, Manoa, what he can do, the upside that he brings, I think there would be more excitement with him.
I think we're going to get to see TJ Zoik get those opportunities in the big league early in the season, in big leagues early in the season. And it should be like just really interesting to see how he responds to that. Because like that's a guy who was, you know, trending in very much the wrong direction just a year ago. And now it looks like, you know, maybe has, you know, revived some things with his career. Yeah. So I don't know. That's just, you know, it's nice. Nice to talk about good things, Ben. First yeah. half is all bad things. This is the good things. Sorry, this is the good vibes segment. Let's keep it rolling with velocity a little bit, actually, but a different kind of velocity. Ben, do you know who among Blue Jays position players leads the team in average exit velocity this spring?
Well, as a follower of @ArdenSwelling, I do know this because you tweeted it out the other day. So I can tell you that it's Alejandro Kirk.
And I can tell you that you're wrong.
What?
it's Riley Adams. The thing is, he's only got three balls in play.
Oh, okay.
So well, I said that is too small of a sample. Yeah. Let's make it much more statistically significant at 10. Right? Again, spring training samples, very small. But yes, minimum 10 balls in play. Alejandro Kirk is leading in exit velocity. Riley Adams has an edge, but with only three. But also, if I just arbitrarily move that endpoint up to 11, Alejandro Kirk's out because he only has 10 balls in play. And then it's Vladimir Guerrero Jr. who like is legitimately spraying missiles all over the diamond. Yes. But we're impressive. Here to talk about Alejandro Kirk. Everything coming off of his bat is a rocket. And, you know, we've talked about, you know, last couple episodes, like spring training results don't matter. Like, you know, Breivik Valera could hit 700. Like
Joe Panic could go 100 for 100.
I don't know how much is going to help him. But when you look at that process stuff, right, and you look at, you know, the velo for pitchers, spin rate for pitchers, and you look at exit velo for hitters, that's good to see. Like that yep. tells you something. And so the fact that Alejandro Kirk is, you know, just barreling the ball consistently, I don't know how much that's going to do for him, but it beats the alternative then this spring.
Yeah, it does. So let's advance the discussion here because we talked about it a few weeks ago and we kind of made the case, or at least presented the case for keeping Reese McGuire on the Major League roster. Now, 2 weeks away from opening day. So let's start with the caveats here that, all right, we don't know what's going to happen. Injuries could occur. Danny Jansen or Reese McGuire or Alejandro Kirk could get hurt and that would change things. So the Jays are not going to make a decision until they absolutely have to. But if things kind of unfold like this, where do you stand? Has your opinion shifted? And where does your opinion sit right now with respect to who the Jays should roster at that position?
Well, it's different between what they're going to do and like what I would do. I think they're going to carry Kirk to begin the season.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
I think that's what they are going to yeah. do. And I think Reese McGuire will be exposed to waivers yeah. as things stand right now.
So you would do it differently.
For things to change. I cannot, and I've been thinking about this a lot, Ben, because, you know, just kind of understanding that Kirk's probably going to be the guy. Like, I just cannot get it out of my head that, like, you need to prioritize depth.
Interesting.
And I don't know, man. Because, like, look, there's also a part of me that's just like, hey, man, let the best players play, right? Yeah. Like, and to me, Alejandro Kirk is a much better hitter than Reese McGuire. So, like, hey, he's earned it, and the best players should be at the highest level in the majors. But I can't get out of my head that, like, you put Reese McGuire on waivers at the end of spring. The Pittsburgh Pirates pick him up. Now you're down to four catchers on your 40. Danny Jansen takes a foul tip in the opening series and has to miss 6 weeks. And now you're down to like Kirk, Adams, Moreno. And that's your catching depth chart. I would feel, look, if the Blue Jays went out and signed Tyler Flowers, I'd be like, all right, yeah, no problem, right? Like you've got that extra added layer of depth. But as things stand right now, without a Flowers or without a Matt Wieters on hand, it's like it's tenuous, it's thin depth. And this catching depth could go from like somewhat deep to real, real thin, real, real quick if you have some tough circumstances.
It could. Now, okay, let's stay with the Wieters and Flowers as I try to persuade you to my viewpoint, which is that, yeah, if you lose Reese McGuire, it's okay. That's my thesis here. So if the Blue Jays enter the situation that you're outlining and Danny Jansen is hurt and Reese McGuire is claimed, I actually think in that situation, because Flowers and Wieters are both free agents, You call up Scott Boras, who reps Weeders. You say, we got a major league deal for Matt. We would love to have him on this team. He's got a roster spot. It's a $1.5 million guarantee. And Weeders takes that. You know?
For sure. Yeah. If somebody doesn't sign him before then, if somebody else doesn't have an injury before then, right?
Like,
get one of these guys in now, which I understand is hard to do on a minor league deal without like clear opportunity to offer them.
Exactly. But as long as those guys are out there, I mean, you still have that as an option. Like, it's not like the catching market is totally, totally dry at this point.
No. And also, so where did Caleb Joseph end up going? Philly,
Mets.
I think. Mets, yeah. So you could also call it the Mets and just trade for Caleb Joseph.
Yes, right? You could trade for somebody.
So you could do that. So yeah, no, you would have those opportunities. You would certainly feel more comfortable if the guy had actually been in camp with you and had actually been like working with your pitchers and your staff. And you know, in the case of Flowers and Weeders, like what kind of game shape are those guys in?
Yeah,
like how much are they hitting? Like
The hitting would be tough for them.
Right? What type of exposure to velocity have they had? Like, I know Boras will get his guys in front of some high-speed pitching machines and stuff, but it's not the same as, like, being, you know, in spring games or even in a live BP set, you know, environment with a real live arm on the mound.
But at the same time, though, like, the alternative is, all right, you've got Reese McGuire at the plate. So you have a rusty Matt Weeders.
How often is Reese McGuire at the plate over those first 2 weeks of the season?
No, in what I'm saying is, in the situation that Danny Jansen is injured,
Right. Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. Well, no, you'd have all 100 Kirk at the plate.
Yeah. But either way, you have Kirk at the plate then.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, my thing is carrying Kirk on the opening day roster for the first week or two of the season, how many wins is that going to impact? Like, how often is he going to hit? Your lineup is already super, super deep.
Yeah.
You're already going to score a gang of runs. Like, how much is that really moving the needle versus maintaining your depth and having, you know, a McGuire around in case, you know, Jansen goes down. And then you're just bringing Kirk off the taxi squad. You can split time with those two guys. I think Reese McGuire is still a really good defender. And I still think that there is utility to that on a big league roster. And there is value to having that on the big league roster. Although I must say, like, I have been, you know, taken by how many pitchers this spring have like sung Alejandro Kirk's praises behind the plate. Like, it's always kind of been the knock on him, right? Is that, like, obviously the bat is major league capable. You know, like, it's not a huge sample, 25 plate appearances last year and, you know, 10 spring training balls in play, but I haven't seen him struggle against big league pitching yet. Doesn't mean it's not going to happen, but it looks like a big league bat. But is the defense big league and is the game calling big league and all that? So, like, Reese McGuire is ahead of him in those aspects. But I have been taken by, you know, guys like Robbie Ray and Tanner Roark coming out this spring and kind of saying, like, no, like, I actually like throwing to this guy, and this guy's actually got some skill back there. So I just can't get out of, you know, the headspace or the thought that it's a 6 month season and you got to think about the entire race, the entire relay race, rather than just the first leg of it.
Right. Now, I guess, you know, thinking about this through like a kind of replacement level type lens here. So if we accept that because Reese McGuire has some defensive skills, he has familiarity with the pitchers, and he has, you know, he's faced live pitching recently, so he's more warmed up than a guy who's on the free agent market. So there's something there. There's some value there that's above and beyond what you're just going to get if you try to claim someone on waivers, if you try to scrape together a trade. But if we accept that that replacement level does exist and that the Blue Jays, if they really had to, could come up with a catcher somewhere, if a couple of their guys got hurt and they were desperate, then I don't think that the upgrade that McGuire provides over that guy is so big. You know, that's kind of why I land where I do, is because I don't see a huge upgrade that McGuire offers.
No, it's also possible that the Blue Jays, you know, feel confident that McGuire is going to get through waivers. Like, we're kind of assuming someone's going to claim him, which, like, I don't know, youngish catcher, right? Strong 26. Defender. You know, like, you would think that a team somewhere would have room for that on their 40, but maybe the Blue Jays, you know better than we do. And I say, no, we think this guy's going to get through, which is like for the Blue Jays, best case scenario, because then you just put him on your taxi squad or you send him to the alt site and you have Riley Adams on the taxi squad, either or. And you have Kirk and Jansen in the majors, and great. You know, the thing with April that's tricky is there aren't minor league games. So you can't even make the case anymore that, like, well, Kirk would be better, you know, benefited by going to AAA and playing every day. There is no AAA in April. He's going to be going to, he's either going to be on your taxi squad and really not get much development at all, or he's going to be at the alt site, you know, live BP and sim games, which just like is not the same. So, you know, the best place developmentally, like possibly, is the big leagues in April.
It is. So, all right. So I am at this point on the side of just take Kirk. Are you still take McGuire, or have I shifted that at all? Where are you at?
I don't think that it will end up mattering for, you know, as much as we're talking about it, you know, for as much of a discussion as it is.
Yeah.
It kind of feels like one of those things that just isn't going to, like, it's just one of those spring topics that we talk about endlessly.
And it's
like
a fun discussion, but no, it's
remember
not
that year where we talked endlessly about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and when his debut would be in like service time, and he just ended up getting hurt. It was all moot. And it was like, oh my God, how many hours do we talk about this? It feels like one of those things. Yeah. I should be less of a, you know, organizational ghoul. I should just say, put the best players in the big leagues. Let the kids play, man. Let the kids play.
There's a legit case to be made on the other side for keeping depth. Like, I don't think it's like, I think it's a reasonable argument. It's interesting. I ran a poll just out of curiosity on Twitter this week. 84%, 85% of people said they would take Kirk.
So, yeah, as a fan, you should want to see Kirk. He's the exciting young prospect, and he's fun to watch, and he's like already a fan favorite. Like, who doesn't like watching him play, right? It's, of course. As a fan, I don't care about your depth, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting, though, that even that one out of every six people was saying, you know, that they would rather have McGuire. So there is, there are a lot of people who see it the way you do.
Yeah. Not as many as who just want to see the really fun player play baseball at the highest level, which is, you know, is the best argument, I will say. I'll say those people are right. You should want to see the most fun players playing in MLB. So we should all want. Final topic, Charlie Montoyo. Blue Jays picked up the club option on his contract, which will keep him as the, or at least contracted to be the Toronto Blue Jays manager through the 2022 season. He signed a 3-year deal plus an option originally. Blue Jays picked it up. Obviously, you know, a quote unquote vote of confidence, you know, as people in our business like to say. This clearly means the Blue Jays are happy with the job that Charlie Montoyo is doing. I guess my question in these discussions always been is like, how should outsiders be evaluating managers in the modern game? Do we even have the ability to? Because what we actually see of the manager of in-game decision making, you know, for 3 hours on a nightly basis, is like friggin' 5 to 10% of what these guys do throughout a day, and what these guys are evaluated on by their superiors in the front office.
Oh, it's a 24/7 job. I mean, once the season starts, once you're on that on ramp, like it never ends. Same for coaches. Same for anyone around the team. I mean, it's totally never ending. And so absolutely, we do not see anything close to everything. I guess to start, definitely does suggest that there's a level of confidence from the organization in Charlie Montoyo. And, you know, I thought of Rick Renteria as soon as this happened, because sometimes teams have like a transition manager who comes in and he takes over the team, a young team, and he's there when the team is trying to turn that corner, and he has to deal with Alan Hansen and Socrates Brito and Ryan Feuerbend. And then by the time they're ready to win, in comes Joe Maddon, in comes Tony La Russa, and Rick Renteria in those cases was canned. And in neither case was it, you know, because he appeared to be negligent, but it was just the decisions that those ownership groups and front offices made. And that's not the only time that's happened. That happens across baseball, it happens across sports. And in this case, the Jays are sticking with Charlie Montoyo for at least a couple of years. And so it's interesting. I don't think this means that there is any diminishment in pressure that he faces. Managers are hired to be fired. Charlie Montoyo will be fired one day. And so it's just a question of when. That's a fact. But, you know, it is.
No,
you know?
I was going to say, knowing Charlie, like, and how long he grinded in the minors to get here, it's not like he's going to walk away from his first big league job unless he has a very compelling reason to do so. He'll do his job probably pretty much as long as they'll let him. Yeah,
exactly. And so that means he's going to get fired, you know, or there's going to be a parting of ways, whatever you want to call it. That's the nature of being a major league manager. Like, that is what these guys sign up for. It's a tough gig. There's a lot of pressure, and that's the world that he's in. But for now, he has a very good team. He has the confidence of the front office. He's got a coaching staff that, you know, is also expected to stay in place and have some stability. So that's a really exciting place for him to be. And, you know, you have to respect the amount of adversity that this team went through last year, the amount of positivity that, he had set aside the season and the fact that the Jays were homeless. But 2020 was a tough year, I think, across the board for most people. You know, it's almost an exception if you were able to stay positive throughout that. And Charlie Montoya was able to somehow. So, you know, yeah, we'll give him credit for that and see where it goes. But, you know, it is a vote of confidence for him.
Yeah, and it's tough to know what else to say because, like, we don't see him in the clubhouse and we don't see him communicating with everybody in the organization. Like, we don't see so much of his job, right? And, like, really, you know, the in-game decision-making, like, the baseline expectation in 2021 is that you're going to make the appropriate, you know, probabilistic calls in-game. Like, every manager should be able to do that. And I think that so much of the job as manager now is, like, not only, you know, it's managing down certainly to, you know, the personalities in your clubhouse and your players, right? And it's utilizing, you know, your EQ, not just your IQ, but it's also how you manage up. And it's how you manage the front office, you know, and the GM and, you know, the AGM who's sending you texts and the analytics people who are giving you ideas, right? That's the, like, quote unquote collaboration that we hear the Blue Jays talk about. That means, like, okay, so how are you pulling in the info you're getting from R&D and from the analysts? Like, how are you communicating with the training staff and sort of understanding workload management and fatigue? Like, what do you know about the, you know, what's going on in the minors and how, you know, close contact are you keeping with the minor league coordinators and, like, who might be able to help this team down the line, right? And then, like, how do you kind of pull in all that information from all these different areas and then message that to your players, right? Because I think that ultimately, in 2021, like, you just, as a club, you just want a manager who's going to put the players in position to do their best and to fulfill their potential and to perform. Because, like, every MLB ball player has a lot of talent and a lot of skill and a lot of ability. Like, you don't get to this level if you don't. It's the highest level in the game. So I think that for a manager, their job so much today, both on the field and off, by the way, putting them in positions on field, but also putting them in positions off the field, to make them feel comfortable, to build an environment where they, you know, where they want to come to the field every day and where they feel their best and where they're happy and they're in a good headspace and they're feeling positive and welcomed and they feel like their, you know, concerns are heard. They feel like they can come into your office and talk to you about things. They feel encouraged. You know, they don't feel like as soon as they slump, they're going to be, you know, sent off to the minors or they're going to be benched. Like, I know a lot of stuff can kind of be nebulous, but, like, to me, that's sort of like the difference maker as a manager is, can you get your players to perform at their absolute best? And, you know, as an outsider, I have no idea how to measure that or analyze that. But I think clearly, you know, if the picking up of his option tells us anything, it's that the Blue Jays feel Montoya is doing it well.
Yeah. And just such an interesting job. Like, I think because of all those facets that you mentioned, like, it's honestly such a fascinating role to have. And you think about, I mean, I'm sure everyone listening has probably had weeks at work where they're like, man, I just burnt out. You know, I had a lot of work to do, or I have too many emails or too many meetings. Well, Charlie Montoya has emails and he has meetings too. Then he manages a game at night. Then, okay, after that, Monday to Friday, he does it Saturday and then Sunday. And look, no one's saying that this isn't a great job and a dream job for him. No question. He's well compensated for it. That's great. But it is a grind. Like, it is definitely a grind. It's a very challenging job. But for us on the outside, we don't know exactly what goes in, but I find it very interesting to think about that role of major league manager.
Oh, absolutely. And there's always something, right? Like, there's always something going on. Some pitcher's always got an issue, or, you know, a position player's not happy. Or like, you got 26 guys in that clubhouse, and you got all the guys on the taxi squad, you got all your coaches, everybody in the front office. Like, there is so much managing that happens, like, 360, not just like towards which reliever am I going to bring in this spot.
Plus, how would you like it, Arden, if someone did a podcast about our podcast and they're just talking about, you know, whether we had the right topics and, you know, second guessing every interjection and every title that we, you know, like, it's there's a lot of scrutiny, and again, comes with the territory. I'm not saying otherwise, but yeah, very high stress job.
And it's also not to say that like you can't, you know, criticize managers. Like no. On this podcast, we've been critical of
Charlie.
Of Charlie.
Yeah. And,
of bunt decisions, right?
Lineup and, card that doesn't have the right players on it.
Yeah.
That's a bad mistake. Right. Of course.
I was giving him like old school grief last year because he wasn't getting fired up enough.
Right? True. I like that take. You know what? I still agree with that take.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When was it like Rowdy or Vlad got like a quick trigger ejection for like no reason on a ball strike call, but you know, probably Vic Carapazza was that issue when Vic Carapazza like just issued like a blanket ejection to the dugout
or someone had to go?
Dante ended up, right? Dante ended up getting it. And I was like, so wait, you don't even have like a particular stimulus or individual or event that you're just issuing a blanket ejection. That's not how this works. As much as, you know, Charlie running out there and throwing a temper tantrum wouldn't have done anything beyond just like demonstrative like theatrics, like I do think it's better than the alternative, like the potential negative impact of your players questioning like why you weren't sticking up for them, right? Oh, so like I've issued those criticisms for sure.
I want to see Charlie get fired up this year. I hope this is the year that he gets tossed like once a month. It's so great. Manager ejections are just so fun.
You talk to guys who had him in the minors and they say like he was that guy. Like he was like fiery, like would scream and yell and go after umps. And he is kind of like softened a little bit as he's gone to the majors. I don't know if we're going to see him, you know.
I'm kidding.
Much more of that. Oh, all right.
half kidding.
I don't know. There's also, by the way, like it's funny as a manager, you are like the primary spokesperson for the organization when you think about it, right? Like you talk to the media every single day. Nobody else in the organization talks to the media every single day. Like you have to, I was talking about messaging things to players. It's Charlie, like he has to message things to us and then through us to fans, right? Like he's add that on top of all the other things you have to do as a manager. You have to think about like being a press secretary every day. And, you know, think about all the stakeholders who are listening to what you're saying in the media, right? And there's like us and we're going to pick it apart and fans are going to jump all over what you say.
Players,
their players' representation is going to hear things and not like it. And now they're texting Ross Atkins. Like, why is Charlie saying this? Like there's so many ways that things can go wrong with like a soundbite.
Ownership.
As somebody who speaks on a microphone every once in a while, I can tell you, like, it's not so easy.
Right. And yet we're only speaking, we're not speaking on behalf of all of Sportsnet, you know?
No.
Like, that would be, if we had to do that twice a day, that'd be tiring. That'd be a challenging, challenging job.
No, I have enough trouble speaking on behalf of myself.
So, right.
Everybody's mileage is going to vary, but I think that like the job of a manager in 2021 is just like a lot harder than it was, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago. And I think it's always important to remember that what you see on TV is just a fraction of what that individual does throughout their day in that role.
For sure.
That's going to be it for us. He's Ben Nicholson Smith. He's on Twitter at B Nicholson Smith. I'm Arden Zwelling. I am on Twitter at Arden Zwelling. Our producers, as always, are Mike Tassoni and Christian Ryan. We thank them very much for their hard work. We thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next week on At the Letters.